bomb exploded at 7:15 this morning in a parking lot between buildings 347 and 350 at Rhein-Main Air Base. Two people have been killed and 11 others injured, one seriously.
I mean, yeah, I feel like there's just this kind of wall in my life between everything before that and everything after.
An einem Sommerabend im Jahr 1985 betritt Edward Pimentel, ein junger US-Soldat, eine Bar in Wiesbaden. Wenige Stunden später ist er tot. Ermordet in einem nahegelegenen Waldstück von Mitgliedern der Roten Armee-Fraktion. Kurz darauf explodiert eine Bombe auf der Rhein-Main-Airbase bei Frankfurt. Zwei Menschen sterben, viele weitere werden verletzt. Vier Jahrzehnte später blicken wir zurück und sprechen mit Angehörigen, ZeitzeugInnen und WissenschaftlerInnen. Was bedeutete der Mord für die Angehörigen des Opfers? Welche ideologischen Traditionslinien führten zu dieser Tat? Die Gespräche bauen aufeinander auf. Es lohnt sich also, sie in der vorgesehenen Reihenfolge zu hören. Fachbegriffe und vertiefende Informationen findet ihr in den Shownotes. Ein Projekt von Spiegelbild Politische Bildung aus Wiesbaden. Ermöglicht durch eine institutionelle Förderung der Landeshauptstadt Wiesbaden.
Herzlich willkommen zur ersten Folge dieser Gesprächsreihe. Zum Auftakt heute sprechen wir mit Kathleen Pequeno. Sie lebt in Brooklyn, New York und arbeitet als Kommunikationsdirektorin bei einer Stiftung, die sich für soziale Gerechtigkeit einsetzt. In dieser Folge heute wird es zwar auch um ihre Arbeit gehen, aber vor allem um ihre persönliche Geschichte. Denn sie ist die Schwester von Edward Pimentel. Das Gespräch heute führen mein Kollege Matthias Gattoff und ich, Tura Alting. Es ist auf Englisch, aber es wird in den Shownotes auch ein deutsch übersetztes Transkript zu finden sein. Kathleen, first of all, welcome and thank you for being here. You write, people understand the world because of stories. What is the story you want to tell about your brother?
I mean, the story I always have in my head about my brother is just like this story of like a really, not perfect, like, but a young man with so much potential. And he, like a person who was always kind of making the best choices that were available to him. And so, you know, one of the most interesting things about him to me was like, he was actually like a person who in conflict, he often looked for a way for people to, to end their conflicts. And I say that in part because there was a lot of conflict growing up in our family. And he was the person who could smooth out any conflict between any other two people. And that was often his role in our family. And, you know, one of the things to me I know about the story of his death is that he really didn't want to treat the German people like they were the enemy. Right? He was like, I'm in this country and it's a chance to like get to know strangers. You know, to get to like meet people who speak a different language and have like a totally different like world they live in, you know, especially then. And he thought, I mean, I think people could argue whether he was correct, but he thought he was there helping to protect the German people. And he was really intrigued. He was intrigued also by a culture where beer had such prominence. You know, we would talk about that, you know, but he was just trying to have a bigger life. He was trying to put himself in a bigger world. And that is part of actually how he got caught up with the RAF. Like they were looking for someone, they needed someone who wouldn't see them as a threat in order for this particular plan they laid to work. And they found it. They found like a young American who was like, I'm going to meet some German people and get to know them. So, and when I think about like, you know, a big brother, like he was a really great big brother in that way. So I always grew up wanting to be like him. And so when I think about his story and what I take from it, I'm like, that is still, you know, I'm not going to say I'm always particularly good at it, but that is the role that I try and play. I mean, I think I try to be a person that when I see a conflict, I try to figure out a way for as many people as possible to get out of the conflict and heal. I would say that's probably a little, and that's different than I think what he could see. I mean, also the main thing is, yeah, he was a life cut short. That's, you know, one of the main things. I mean, who knows what he would have gone. That's always the question about war, right? All these people's lives get caught up in war, and so many people's lives end, and you're like, what did we rob from ourselves, from our future? By indiscriminately killing people and saying, well, but I had to because it's war, you know, a story which continues even now.
In the film, you call Edward your superhero. Could you share what he was like as a person and what it felt like to have him as your brother?
I mean, my brother was a middle child and was often in the middle of a lot of conflicts. And one of the most interesting things about him, I think, was that he had a sense that he was supposed to be a protector of everyone from a very young age. There was different forms of violence and poverty that were part of our lives, including his life from a really young age. And I think he was like really like the responsible oldest son, you know. And yeah, and he also was, by the way, a big brother who would sit on me and make me punch myself in the head with my own hands. Like he was not he was not a perfect person. But also he was really like, I'm always going to look out for you. Like I'm your big brother. Like that was part of how he related to people, you know. And even him joining the army was that, during this journey that I was taking to kind of learn more about the folks who killed him, and to, I don't know, like figure out if there was more healing for me to do. I met someone who knew him in the army and who talked about, I met someone who had gone through basic training with my brother. And in basic training, there was a point where apparently he confided in this guy that he was like, you know, I don't know about this. They had been taking rifle training or something. And he was like, I don't want to kill people. You know, that's not what I signed up for. And this other young, you know, person and other young man in basic training was like, oh, Ed, you're not gonna have to kill anybody. You know, that's not what's happening. I got to meet this young man, you know, then when he was an adult many decades later. I met him around like 2011, I want to say, or 2012. And he was really burdened by it. He was like, you know, I talked him into staying. I was like, nothing ever happens. Like, you just do your years. And then, you know, he had signed up for 4 years. You just do your 4 years. And then, yeah, then you're done. And then you go on and live your life. You're not going to kill anybody. But he said that ultimately my brother made the decision to stay in the army because he felt like his family, like he knew he was making a stable income and it would set him up to make to get a good job and get a stable income when he left the army, because he didn't really have any options for college. And he wanted to be a provider for our family. And, you know, and this friend of his from basic told me, he told me, I have my whole family to support. And I'm like, that's ultimately why he decided to stay in the army. And I think, you know, the thought of that this guy was right, like, he's not going to wind up on a battlefield, you know. And yeah, I'll just pause there.
Do you remember when and how you first heard about your brother's death?
One of the very strange things about my experience of my brother's death is that I was not with my mother when she found out. I was not even anywhere near my mother. So our family is originally from Mexico and the Rio Grande Valley, which is near Texas. And so I still have family there. My My mother wanted us to have a childhood that included Texas. And so we went down to stay with relatives every year. And we stayed with my aunt and uncle and my cousins. And not in the place where she grew up, in another part of Texas, but in the, you know, like, I don't know. It's true. Like, I have this whole childhood experience of Texas that is similar to my mother's. And so I was the youngest child. So I was still in, I was, so I was still going down to Texas when that happened. I was 15. And by that point, I went by myself. My sister had already kind of gotten too old to go. My brother was in the army. And so, yeah, I still went every summer. And so I was down there with my aunt and uncle. And I mean, I still remember the earlier part of the day because I have just viscerally, and it's like 40 years later, I still have this very visceral memory of how ordinary the earlier part of the day was, which is funny. I feel like at the time I was thinking, like, you have to hold on to that. Like, there was this world before he was gone. And some of my last memories of that are like, we played until it was too dark to play outside. And then my aunt and uncle had gone out for the evening and they had left me like in charge because I was 15 and my cousins were younger than me. So I was in charge. It was also a very big, you know, it was one of the first times that my aunt and uncle had actually left all of us kids in the house in kind of recognition of they're all getting older. And so one of the really strange parts was that I found out when there was no adult around. And my mom called the house, you know, because houses had phones back then. And my mom called the house and I answered the phone. And immediately I was like, what's wrong? Because I could tell that her voice sounded like something I had not heard since I was a really, really little kid, which was that her voice was like raw from crying. And she was like, I need to talk to your aunt. And I was like, she's not here. What's going on? What's going on? And she was like, I have to talk to your aunt. I have to talk to your aunt. I can't talk to you. And I was like, you have to tell me. You have to tell me. And we just had this like brief, frantic exchange. And then finally she just blurted it out like, he's dead. And I was like, who's dead? You know, and she's like, your brother's dead. And, you know, I mean, yeah, I feel like it's just this kind of wall in my life between everything before that and everything after. And which is to say that certainly there were hard things before and there were hard things after, but there has never been anything in my life that left me so so changed by just this idea that you could kill, that suddenly like a really good person could be just gone. Like in someone you're really close to. And I literally, you know, he's my big brother who's 5 years older than me. Like I had never been in nor imagined a world without him. And, you know, I mean, that's the thing, right? I understand, like, to the world, he is this, you know, kind of relatively unimportant person. You know, he was the, like, he was immediately above the lowest pay rank you could have in the U.S. Army. You know, he is a person not of any importance, you know, but for us, like, he was, I mean, for me, he was just my touchstone, like the person who I always knew I could talk to and things would get better, things would be better. And yeah, and then, but my mom, this also tells you something about my relationship with my mother. My mom was like, I have to go. So we just got off the phone. We were on the phone for like 2 minutes. And she was like, tell your aunt to call me. And I was like, okay. And I, you know, just kind of stood there, you know, in this dark room. It was so funny too, like all the lights were out. We had been watching TV in another room, so the lights were out. I just stood in the dark and I was like, this is what this is like. And I remember the song that was on the radio, like I remember the appliances that were making noise, like, you know. So yeah, so I went and I got my older cousin, who was close in age to me, and I told him, and then we agreed that we would wait to tell my youngest cousin because she was just young, and you know, and we were like, we're gonna wait, like we were like, we'll be the you know, we're the kids in charge. Yeah, and I just sat for a while with it. Then my cousin and I didn't sit together. I mean, I think we were a family not very accustomed to talking about feelings. So, you know, and then my aunt and uncle came home, and I was actually sitting in front of the house so that I could see them coming, and it was like there was a way it was so different and more real once I told them, you know. And so they came in, and I think they were like, why are you sitting outside? There's bugs, you know. And I just said, you know, Eddie's dead. And they were stunned. They were stunned, and I was like, you have to call my mom. And my aunt was like, I have to call my sister. She just turned to my uncle and was like, I have to call my sister. And you know, and then it just kind of went off from there. I mean, there is a way. I have talked to a lot of family members of murder victims, you know, since 1985 when all of this happened. And there's so many different ways that people find out and it unfolds. You know, there's a part of me that's like, our separation from the criminal legal system in this, I think, has made it so different than what many people experience, you know, in most places. Like, we did not have contact with prosecuting authorities. We weren't, you know, and also, like, in the very beginning, like, no one actually knew. You know, in the very beginning, it was just like, he's dead, his body's coming back. And it wasn't really understood. Like, you know, we met people from our federal government's law enforcement, like, I want to say within a day or two, who came to interview us about him. They were, you know, they were kind, and they were trying to figure out, like, if it was basically like his own fault that he was killed. The original theories were that he had actually had been maybe like in a drug deal, or that he had run afoul of someone's I'd run afoul of a woman's boyfriend. Like, the first couple of days, it was all just this like mystery. And by the way, I was still not home. I mean, you know, and it was so expensive to talk on the phone. It was like 25 cents a minute. You know, when 25 cents was worth like a lot more. And so my mom was like, we can't talk on the phone very much. So you have to just wait until you get back and I will talk to you. And it was just a few days before I was supposed to come back anyway. So we decided like not to change my ticket. I just had a few more days. But then my aunt came with me for the funeral, you know. And it is, you know, the thing I will say that is really strange is that the US Army has a bunch of protocols for when people die sudden violent deaths and their families are shocked and reeling. And those protocols are actually like good. You know, there was a way in which I was also like, the army sends people. I didn't know this at the time. I found out from my mom later that they come to your door, and she came to the door. You know, she answered her door, she was home, and they were like, are you home alone? And she said, yeah, I'm getting ready for work. And they were like, we're gonna wait, get someone to come be with you, get someone you love and trust to come be with you, and we will wait. Which, of course, then you kind of know what's happening. Or my mother, like, of course, is like, oh my God. But she called, you know, she called her parents, my grandparents who helped raise us, and they came down. And those protocols are really helpful. I mean, those protocols have been kind of developed through the loss of so many thousands and thousands of families and individual young people usually. And you know, those protocols are really good. Like, they made sure she wasn't alone and that they did not leave her alone with it. And there was someone with us, like, any time between when he died and the funeral, there was someone from the army there the whole time to be like, we're going to help you navigate this. There's all these decisions to make. Like, you suddenly have to, like, pick out a coffin for your child, like, all of that. And they help you through it. And so, I mean, I talk with people now who talk about bereavement in the United States, and I'm like, everyone should have this. It shouldn't just be for people if you are killed in war, which is kind of how that protocol got developed. It's a really reasonable set of practices to kind of hold a family when this sudden horrible thing has happened.
You just mentioned that it wasn't usual to talk about feelings in your family. Did that change after Edward's death? And how did you all cope with such a tragedy?
Yeah. You know, the main feeling that was generally acceptable to talk about in my family was anger. That was kind of a real, that is like one of the through lines of my childhood, was that anger was present so often. Like, there was, someone was really angry. A lot of times it was my grandparents, you know, specifically, may he rest in peace, my grandfather. And so after the murder, I do think that, like, we were all angry, you know, and I think, like many people in that situation, I was immediately like, tell me who to be angry at. Tell me who needs to die for me to feel better. You know, I was raised very politically conservative. I was raised very like, there's probably someone to blame for whatever problem you have. And if that person suffers, you will feel better. You will feel justice. And right, very sadly, something that is now an attitude that has taken over my country, right? Whatever hurt you have, you can be angry about it. You should be angry about it. And you should be finding out who to blame for it and make them suffer instead, like as if it's a zero-sum game and you will suffer less when they suffer more. And that was really, you know, so the first few days we didn't know anything, and then the letter appeared in the media. My mother might have learned about it before we read it in the paper, but, you know, all of this was happening very far away. None of us spoke any German. None of us knew much about Germany. I mean, literally all I knew was what he wrote back in his letters, which was things like, the beer is really good here. The clothes fit differently. Like, things that would not help you navigate this. And certainly nothing about anyone disliking the presence of Americans, you know, there. And so, yeah, once we found out, I was like, and I was immediately like, terrorists? Wait, they're Germans. How can they be terrorists? Like, the United States media was always that terrorists were from the Middle East. Also a thing that largely continues to this day. And so I was just like really confused. And I was just like, I don't know who they are. I hate them. I want them all to die. And I think a lot of my friends, you know, they just kind of like, they could sit with it. They could sit with it. They kind of didn't know who these people were. None of us understood anything about what the political situation was. There were like a couple of short stories about it in the newspaper. And so my family, just all we agreed on was they were horrible communists. Like, what, you know, my grandfather was like, I always knew the communists were the worst people on earth. And now they've done this. You know, and we were just really, I think the word is like cocooned in grief. And I think we also felt a very strange shame about it. And this is also something I've seen a lot of other family members of murder victims go through. Like, you wind up like ashamed and embarrassed that your family member was murdered. It's completely irrational, but it's strangely common. And because you don't want people to see like your heart broken wide open. You don't want to see being like, yeah, people can be this awful and it's permanent. It's not even like the other harms. Like other harms people do to you, you can be like, and then I survived, or then I rose above. But like you're just like, he's gone. He's gone. He's never going to rise above anything again. It's the story's just over until someone gets punished. The story's over. And I think our family mostly talked about that and being like, but they're like wily communists. So, they're never going to get caught. And I think we just kind of wrapped ourselves in our grief. My grandparents started, like, after the funeral, my grandparents walked to the cemetery most days of the week to go visit him for years until they were like not able to walk. And they were not that old when he was killed. They were in their 60s when he was killed. So they had many years of walking ahead of them, and they would walk us about a 20-minute walk to the cemetery every day. And they would walk and see him, and they would take pictures, and they got to know the squirrels and all of this. And I was just like, you people are so embarrassing. And also, I mean, again, in terms of really getting to do this in a really bizarre way, my school was not my local school, and so people didn't know that he was dead at my school, except for the four or five people that I told. And I didn't tell any of the teachers there, and neither did my mother. And so I just kind of went back to school in September, and everybody was like, oh my God, what'd you do this summer? And I'd be like, nothing. Like nothing happened this summer. My summer sucked. And that was it. And I didn't talk about it, for quite a while. And I think my close friends, including the filmmaker, Desirina Almorati, who made that film, I think we're just like, they were also, we were all like 15, 16 years old, and they were trying to figure out on their own, like some way to make this better for me. And they just held a lot of space for me to be sad and mad and mad and mad and sad. And it made a big difference. The fact that I got to just kind of have some of that grieving with them helped a lot. And a couple of them were like, I think, I mean, I guess it makes sense to hate them, but what's it doing to you to hate them? And but I think it was probably several years after it, and then and then there's a really complicated story of like, I had to leave home. I didn't want to leave home. I had to leave home. Because then I came out as a lesbian, which also I was totally obsessed with. Oh my God, my brother would hate it. My brother would hate me. He wouldn't approve, but I don't think I can help it. And then my mom was like, you have to leave. And, but she was also deeply embarrassed by that. She was like, I have the one dead son. Now I have this, like lesbian daughter, and she was just like, just don't tell people, and I won't tell people either, and you can just go to college, which was one of the funniest, like, strangest things in my life, is that my mother wasn't going to help me get into college. She was like just too overrun with grief. She was totally like, why do I still have a person like constantly asking for help with getting like fed and having clothing and all of that jazz? She was just not able to parent anymore. And and then I And then she found out I was lesbian, and she was like, I can't take it anymore, and I don't want anyone to know. She was like, you just stay on your side of the apartment, and I will stay on my side of the apartment, and you are going to college. It's like, and don't tell, and you're going to leave home because you're going to college. And I was like, and at the by then I had found a counselor, and the counselor was like, perfect. I've been telling you to go to college. Now you're going to go to college. And I left home, and it was really outside, I think, the shadow of my family that I started talking to people more, but not for several more years. And then people at times, I would say the single biggest thing that people did was listen without encouraging me towards anger or anything. And also not saying what any number of political leftists will say to me. And I've heard this so many times in 40 years. They'll be like, you just need to understand the political context in which the action against your brother was taken. Which I will just say is not helpful. Right? And, yeah, So I just needed a bunch of people just listening and letting me talk through it and not letting me act on my anger, which was fortunately, there was no way to do it. It was happened a really long way away. And, you know, I think the way in which it changed my life the most was me realizing that everything I had understood about war was a lie. Because we had been raised, you know, with kind of a U.S. military family perspective on it, which is that people go to war and the good people prevail, except for Vietnam. You know, like the U.S. Is really funny that, you know, the righteous people prevail and young people die, but it's, you know, it's just the price you pay for the great world we live in. And I was like, this is just the stupidest thing. Like someone shot him and killed him because they were like, we're at war, we get to do that. And they killed other people. And then soon I was like, and then people kill them because they're like, we're at war, we get to kill them. And I was like, this is just the, it's so funny. I mean, I guess I will say it, assuming that you will figure out how to cut it or bleep or whatever. I was young and I was like, this is just the stupidest fucking thing I've ever heard. Like, once you see this up close, like once I saw my brother's body, I was like, how does anyone think this will solve any problem? And I mean, or I guess I won't say, I did not have that thought when I saw his body. When I saw his body, I was like, this is the worst thing ever. And then within a few years, I was just really haunted by that. I mean, I still remember what he looked like in his coffin. You know, only the family was allowed to see because he was disfigured from the terms of his death. And, you know, yeah, I was just like, you know, and that was really when I became an activist. And I think, for me, it became this question of like, people look for justice any way they can. And when you take away reasonable ways for them to do it, they turn to unreasonable ways. And I also began what is really funny, because I didn't describe it this way until after I kind of went on that journey a few years ago that you know, Desarina captured on film, where I realized like I've kind of been on my own restorative justice project, you know, because I was basically like, I think the cause they were fighting for made some sense to me. I was like, I'm, you know, I think it is fair to say that the U.S. military presence is not always done with the best interests of the world in mind, right? That sometimes the U.S. Army and the people in it are used for purposes that they don't, I mean, that they don't choose and that don't benefit them or their families or our way of life. But that, yeah, like I can pay attention to their words enough to say like they are not 100% wrong about every single thing. And I think the difference is pursuing these things through violence is not actually going to get us a better world. It's not going to get us a more peaceful world. It's not going to get us a more just world. You know, you can't kill your way to a more peaceful world in spite of, I think, some of the lessons of the 20th century. And so I basically have been on this, like, it turns out, like 30 odd year restorative justice project where I am in political movements to try and hold them to their principles and make sure that they don't harm people through violence. And so I have been at all these different actions and all these different places and settings because I'm like, I got a project here, which is that if I think you're right, I will support you. And I want you to do it in the most just way, the way most consistent with the things we say we stand for. And that's how I wound up in like, yeah, 30 plus years of working and pretty much like support of, I have wound up with like over 30 years supporting like pretty much every kind of justice movement that exists in the United States, like in some form or another, by giving time, skill, money, perspective, you know, mostly time, you know, to really hold these movements to our shared values.
Yeah, you've done an impressive range of projects and work around social justice and supporting disadvantaged communities, Would you say that losing your brother and experiencing pain and injustice so early on shaped the path that led you to this work?
I mean, I think before my brother was killed, my plan was to follow him into the U.S. military. Because I was like, that's where good people go to do good things. And I think he was thinking, I think a lot of people in my family were thinking that I would go to college, that I would be the first of among the siblings of the three of us to go to college. And I was like, well, I'll go to college if then I can wind up, you know, somewhere in proximity to my brother. My brother's going to be in the army. So how am I going to do that? I mean, I found myself not that particularly interested in the, so there is a thing in high schools in New York City and all across the country to try and draw high school students who are college bound into the military. It's called Reserve Officers Training Corps, or ROTC. And so, but what was funny was in the first 2 years that I was there, like I did like take a peek at ROTC, and I was like, oh, and so ROTC is ROTC, Reserve Officers Training Corps. And I was like, oh, I don't know about this. So, I mean, so I think it's possible that I was never on that path. But yeah, I mean, my original path was to follow my brother. Whatever my brother did, I wanted to do. And that was going to involve, I thought, some form of serving in the military. And then after he died, it was part of me being like, wait a minute, if everything I've learned about war is a lie, what else could be wrong? And then I came out as a queer person, as a lesbian. And then I was like, wait, if everything I've learned about queer people, about lesbians is also not true, what else could I have like been wrong about? And then I just started a period of several years, just like kind of, you know, trying to learn more and learn more about people that I had dismissed. I think that was kind of the key thing. I had dismissed people who were peaceniks, right? That's kind of the dismissive term in English, peaceniks. I had dismissed people who were peaceniks. And then I was like, maybe the peaceniks are onto something. And so I was reading things about that. One of the most affecting things that I did was I read, there was a brand new biography of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. that came out in the 80s, and it was called Let the Trumpet Sound. And it was a very long biography of Dr. King. And I would never have read that before his death. But when I was like, you know, and actually one of my peers recommended it to me. They were like, I think you'd find this really interesting, because he talked about nonviolence as a strategy to change the world. And I think now, you know, now it is 40 years plus since that book came out, and people act as if like Dr. King was always a hero. But when that book came out, that biography, Dr. King was still kind of vaguely considered an enemy by a lot of people in the United States, right? People were like, he integrated things, and they didn't think that was a good thing. And I read that book, and I was like, oh, I don't think I understood what was going on in the 1960s in the United States until I read that book. And you know, a lot of his activism was also in the 50s, which was a very repressive time here. And that's when I was like, oh, and he talked about really early in the book, he talked about originally how he had hate in his heart for white people. And that's when I was like, oh, you can hate people and then decide that hating them is hurting you more than hurting them. That's basically what he talked about, you know. And he was like, I decided and said that I had a spiritual calling, which was to help white people, you know, harm less, which would benefit me, benefit my people, and also benefit them. Like, everybody wins. And I was just intrigued by it, and intrigued by how much he had to overcome and how much violence was directed at him. And he just kept saying, this, when people see this, this will be the proof that our cause is just. And that he wasn't like, and that he specifically didn't want to suffer in private. He was like, part of the problem is people don't realize what is being done to Black America. People need to see it. And that most people are basically good enough that when they see it, they will want to undo it. And I read that when I was like, yeah, like 17 or 18 years old. And I was like, oh, like, I think this guy's like onto something, you know. And I would say that's also where I basically have like decided to orient my life towards, like, we have to be able to he talks about this, we have to be able to live with ourselves in the new world that we create. So, and yeah, that's what I've been kind of doing for decades. And that extends all the way to trying to find meaningful ways, you know, to support, you know, the human rights of everyone living in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, like everyone. And what does it look like in any conflict to say, I'm not going to write off anyone. I am not going to minimize the humanity of anyone in this situation. And I've found any number of organizations to support, mostly with money, some with time, sometimes showing up at their demonstrations, to just say, there are people here who are like, we're not going to stop remembering that everyone in the situation is a human being. That doesn't mean everything they do is right or just. Quite the, you know, we're there because people still do horrible things. But I would say the first place I made this commitment was with the RAF in my life, where I was like, you know, at least 10 years later, where I was like, there has to be a way to talk about this where I don't minimize their humanity. But I'm not going to say it was okay that you killed my brother. Like, no. Like, both things can be true, right? People can still be basically human beings, and I'm not letting go of that. Even though obviously I think this is monstrous. I mean, they just threw him away like a used tissue, you know. They just left his body somewhere. You know, like, what is more monstrous than that? But I'm not letting go of being like, I still want them treated like human beings. I want them to have a future. My brother doesn't have a future, but I want a future. I want everyone in this situation to have a future. If the worst possible thing is taking someone's future away from them, I will not sign off on that for anybody. You know, and I'm like, yeah, that's like my lesson from war. I mean, I think lots of people take different lessons from war. Like, that's my lesson, and I'm sticking to it.
Thank you so much for your perspective. The points you've just raised are ones we'd like to come back to in our next conversation, but for now we'd like to bring this one to a close. Thank you so much. Im nächsten Gespräch mit Wolfgang Krauser werden wir über die genauen historischen Abläufe sprechen. Außerdem werden wir nochmal einen Fokus darauf legen, was war eigentlich die Rote Armee-Fraktion? Was versteht man unter einer Generation der RAF? Und welche Bezüge gibt es zu Wiesbaden? Vielen Dank fürs Zuhören und bis zur nächsten Folge.